The spoor led them over the cold grey ash, amongst the blackened and bared branches of the burned-out jesse bush, and up the rising funnel of the narrow valley. Jan Sharut led. He had discarded his faded tunic for a sleeveless leather jerkin with loops for the Enfield cartridges across the chest. Zuger followed him closely, carrying the sharps and 50 extra rounds, together with his 2-gallon water bottle. His gun-bearers, in strict order of seniority, backed him, each with his burden of blankets and water bottles, food bag, powder flask, and ball pouch, and, of course, the big smooth-bored elephant guns. Zuger was anxious to see Jan Sharut work. The man talked a very good elephant hunt, but Zuger wanted to know if he was as good on the spoor as he was at telling about it around the campfire. The first test came swiftly, when the valley pinched out against another low cliff of impassable rock, and it seemed as though the great beasts they followed had taken wing and soared away above the earth. "Wait," said Jan Sharut, and cast swiftly along the base of the cliff. A minute later he whistled softly, and Zuger went forward. There was a smudge of dark ash on a block of ironstone, and another above it, seeming to lead directly into sheer rock face. Jan Sharut scrambled up over the loose scree at the foot of the cliff and disappeared abruptly. Zuger slung his rifle and followed him. The blocks of ironstone had fractured in the shape of a giant staircase, each step as high as his waist, so that he had to use a hand to climb. Even the elephants would have extended themselves to make each step, rising on their back legs, as he had seen them do at the circus. For an elephant is incapable of jumping. They must keep 2 feet on the earth before they can heave their ungainly bulks upwards. Zuger reached the spot where Jan Sharut had disappeared, and stopped short in amazement at the threshold of the stone portals, invisible from below, which marked the beginning of the ancient elephant road. The portals were symmetrically formed in fractured rock, and had eroded through the softer layers, leaving straight joints, so they seemed to have been worked by a mason. The opening was so narrow that it seemed impossible that such a large animal could pass through. And looking above the level of his own head, Zuger saw how over the centuries their rough skin had worn the stone smooth as thousands upon thousands of elephant had squeezed through the gap. He reached up and plucked a coarse black bristle, almost as thick as a swan vesta, from a crack in the surface. Beyond the natural gateway, the gap in the cliffs widened and rose at a more gentle pitch. Already Jan Sharut was 400 yards away up the pathway. "Come!" he called, and they followed him up. The elephant road might have been surveyed and constructed by the Corps of Engineers, for never was the gradient steeper than 30 degrees, and when there were natural steps, they were never higher than a man or an elephant could comfortably negotiate, although it seemed there were always accidents, for within a quarter of a mile they found where one of the big animals had missed his footing and struck the tip of one tusk against the ironstone edge. The tusk had snapped above the point, and 20 pounds of ivory lay in the path. The fragment was worn and stained, so thick around that Zuger could not span it with both hands, but where it had sheared the fresh ivory was a lovely, finely grained porcelain white. Jan Sharut whistled again when he saw the girth of the fragment of tusk. "I've never seen an elephant so big," he whispered, and instinctively checked the priming of his musket. They followed the road out of the rocky pass on to forested slopes, where the trees were different, more widely spaced. And here the three old bulls had paused to strip off long slabs of bark from the misasa trunks before moving on. A mile further along the road, they found the chewed balls of bark still wet and smelling of elephant saliva, a rank, gamey smell. Zuger held one of the big stringy balls to his nostrils and inhaled the elephant smell. It was the most exciting odour he had ever known. When they rounded a shoulder of the mountain, there was a terrifying drop of open blue space before them, in which the tiny shapes of vultures soared. Zuger was sure that it was the end of the road. "Come!" Jan Sharut whistled. And they stepped out onto the narrow secret ledge, with the deep drop close at hand, and followed the road that had been smoothed for them by tens of thousands of roughly padded feet over the centuries. Zuger at last was allowing himself to hope. For the road climbed always, and there seemed to be a definite purpose and direction to it, unlike the meandering game trails of the valley. This road was going somewhere, climbing and bearing determinedly, southwards. Zuger paused a moment and looked back. Far behind and below, the sunken plain of the Zambezi shimmered in the blue and smoky haze of heat. The gigantic baobab trees seemed like children's miniatures. The terrible ground over which they had laboured for weeks seemed smooth and inviting, and far away, just visible through the haze, the serpentine belt of darker, denser vegetation marked the course of the great wide river itself. Zuger turned his back upon it, and followed Yan Shirut up and around the shoulder of the mountain. And a new and majestic vista opened around him as dramatically as though a theatre curtain had been drawn aside. Another steep slope stretched away above the cliffs, and there were luxuriant forests of marvellously shaped trees. The colours of their foliage was pink and flaming scarlet and iridescent green. These lovely forests reached up to a rampart of rocky peaks that Zuger was certain must mark the highest point of the escarpment. There was something different with this new scene, and it took Zuger some moments to realize what it was. Then suddenly he drew a deep breath of pleasure. The air fanning down from the crest was sweet and cool as that on a summer's evening on the South Downs, but carrying with it the scent of strange shrubs and flowers and the soft exotic perfume of that beautiful pink and red forest of masasa trees. That was not all, Zuger realized suddenly. There was something more important still. They had left the Tsetse fly belt behind them. It was many hours and 1,000 feet of climbing since he had noticed the last of the deadly little insects. The land ahead of them now was clean. They were entering a land where man could live and rear his animals. They were leaving the killing heat of the harsh and forbidding valley for something softer and cleaner, something good, Zuger was certain of it, at last. He stared about him with delight and wonder. Below him in the void, a pair of vultures came planing in on wide-stretched pinions, so close that he could see every individual feather in their wingtips, and above the shaggy mound of their nest that clung precariously to a fissure in the sheer rock cliff, they beat at the air, hovering, before settling upon the nest site. Clearly, Zuger heard the impatient cries of the hungry nestlings. On the rock shelf, high above his head, a family of hyrax, the plump, rabbit-like rock dussy, sat in a row and stared down at him with patent astonishment, fluffy as children's toys, until at last they took fright and disappeared into their rookie warrens with the speed of a conjurer's illusion. The sun, sinking through the last quadrant of its course, lit all with richer and mellower light, and turned the cloud ranges to splendour, tall mushroom-shaped thunderheads of silver and brightest gold, touched with fleshy pink tongues and the tinge of wild roses. Now at last Zuger could not doubt where the elephant road was leading him, and he felt his spirit soaring. His body, wearied from the climb, was suddenly recharged with vigour, with vaulting expectations, for he knew that those rugged peaks about him were the threshold, the very frontiers, of the fabled kingdom of Monomotapa. He wanted to push past Yan Shirut on the narrow track, and run ahead up the broad, beautiful forested slope that led to the crest. But the little yellow Hottentot stopped him with a hand upon his shoulder. "Look," he hissed softly, "there they are." Zuger followed his outflung arm and saw instantly. Far ahead, amongst those magical red and pink groves, something moved, vast and grey and slow, ethereal and insubstantial as a shadow. He stared at it, feeling his heartbeat quicken at this, his first glimpse of an African elephant in its savage habitat. But the slow grey movement was immediately screened by the dense foliage. "My telescope," he snapped his fingers urgently behind his back, never taking his eyes from the spot where the huge beast had disappeared, and Matthew thrust the thick cylinder of cool brass into his hand. With fingers that shook slightly, he pulled out the sections of the spyglass, but before he could lift it to his eyes, the tree that had screened the elephant's body began to tremble and shake, as though it had been struck by a whirlwind, and faintly they heard the rending crackle of tearing timber, the squealing protest of living wood. And slowly the tall tree leaned outwards, and then toppled with a crack that echoed off the cliffs like a cannon shot. Zuger lifted the telescope and rested it on Matthew's patient shoulder. He focused the eyepiece. Abruptly, in the rounded field of the glass, the elephant was very close. His head was framed by the foliage of the tree he had uprooted. The vast ears seemed wide as clippers' mainsails, as they flapped lazily, and he could see the puffs of dust that their breeze raised from the massive grey withers. Clearly he could see the dark wet tear path from the little eye down the seared and wrinkled cheek. And when the animal raised its head, Zuger drew breath sharply at the unbelievable size of the double arches of stained yellow ivories. One tip was foreshortened, broken off cleanly, and the ivory was brilliant snowy white in the fresh break. As Zuger watched, the bull used his trunk with its rubbery fingers of flesh at the tip to pluck a handful of the delicate new leaves from the fallen tree. He used his trunk with the finesse of an expert surgeon, and then drooped open his triangular lower lip and thrust the leaves far down his own throat, and his roomy old eyes wept with slow contentment. An urgent tap on his shoulder disturbed Zuger, and irritably he lifted his eye from the telescope. Jan Sharut was pointing further up the slope. Two other elephants had drifted into view from out of the forest. Zuger refocused upon them and then gasped. He had thought the first elephant massive, and here was another bull just as big. Yet it was the third elephant which daunted his belief. Beside him, Jan Sharut was whispering with suppressed tension, making his voice hoarse and his slanted black eyes shine.
The younger bulls are his two askari, his indunas. They are his ears and his eyes, for in his great age he is probably almost deaf and more than half blind. But look at him. Is he not still a king?
The oldest bull was tall and gaunt, taller by almost a head than his protégés. But the flesh seemed to have wasted off the ancient frame. His skin hung in baggy folds and creases from the massive framework of bones. He was thin, in the way that some old men are thin. Time had eroded him, seeming to leave only skin and stringy sinew and brittle bone. Matthew had been right in his description. The bull moved the way an old man moves, as though each joint protested with rheumatic pangs, and the weight of ivory he had carried for 100 years was at last too much for him. The ivory had once been the symbol of his majesty, and it was still perfect, flaring out from the lip and then turning in again so the points almost met. The gracious curves seemed perfectly matched, and the ivory was a lovely butter yellow, unblemished despite the dominant battles he had fought with them, despite the forest trees that the bull had toppled with them and stripped of their bark, or the desert roots he had dug from the stony soil with them. But now at last these great tusks were a burden to him. They wearied him, and he carried his head low as they ached in his old jaws. It had been many years now since he had used them as fearsome weapons to keep control of the breeding herds. It had been as many years since he had sought the company of the young cows and their noisy squealing calves. Now the long yellow ivories were a mortal danger to him, as well as a source of discomfort and pain. They made him attractive to man, his only enemy in nature. Always it seemed that the hunters were camped upon his spoor, and the man's smell was associated with the flash and thudding discharge of muzzle-loading firearms or the rude, stinging intrusion of sharpened steel into his tired old flesh. There were pieces of beaten iron potleg and of round, hardened lead ball deep in his body. The shot lying against the bone castle of his skull had become incisted with gristle and formed lumps as big as ripe apples beneath the skin, while the scars from the arrows and stabbing spears, from the fire-hardened wood spikes of the dead fall-trap, had thickened into shiny grey scars and become part of the rough, folded, and creased mantle of his bald grey hide. Without his two askari, he would long ago have fallen to the hunters. It was a strangely intimate relationship that knit the little herd of old bulls, and it had lasted for 20 years or more. Together they had trekked tens of thousands of miles, from the Kashan Mountains in the far south, across the burning, waterless wastes of the Kalahari Desert, along the dry riverbeds where they had knelt and with their tusks dug for water in the sand. They had wallowed together in the shallow lake of Ingami, while the wings of the waterfowl darkened the sky above them. And they had stripped the bark from the forests along the Linyati and Chobe rivers, and crossed those wide rivers, walking on the bottom with just the tips of their trunks raised above the surface to give them breath.